Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film. It's the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
With COVID. So COVID, remote.
From my COVID den.
From your COVID Hello. Den. And our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Not got COVID. All okay at that end?
I'm okay at this end, although I'm beginning to worry that you can catch it through podcasting, like through the wire.
Matt's going to breathe heavily into his mic.
Horror movies always tell you to fear technology, so I think somehow it's going to get me now. But there you go.
Okay. Well, this week we are going to be talking to Craig Roberts about his underdog story, The Phantom of the Open, and we'll be rating that, plus Affleck and De Armas's erotic thriller, Deep Water. Can't wait to get into that. Dating movie Fresh, horror master, and dramatisation of the WeWork trailblazers in We Crashed. But before we get to them, what else have you been watching, Jamie?
Well, I've just got back from the Glasgow Film Festival a couple of days ago, or two or three days ago. So I've spent like 7 or 8 days up there just watching a lot of stuff, like it's kind of 4 movies a day, all sorts. Yeah,
just a usual day for you, Jamie, though. Well, you say that like it's unusual, but that is just what you do anyway.
No, I normally watch 2 or 3 a day, so watching 3 or 4 a day is a slight step up. 5 a lot of days, actually, at the Glasgow Film Festival. But saw lots of good movies there, which we'll be covering in coming weeks on the podcast and in the magazine. So,
and didn't eat a vegetable once the entire time you were there?
I didn't. No,
why?
And that's not,
you do know that vegetables are available in Scotland.
I know this isn't a reflection on Glasgow. I tweeted about this, and loads of people thought I was having a pop at Glasgow over the fact that, you know, no one eats vegetables, and I wasn't at all. There was lots of vegetables available. I just didn't eat any because I was kind of running between screenings and just grabbing fast food, and I literally just had a week of McDonald's and fried breakfasts and chips and stuff like that.
That is the festival way, though.
Yeah,
really.
It's festival diet.
It is a festival diet. My poor wife, she always says when I come back from festivals, for a couple of days I'm just miserable because I've had an awful diet for a week and I just come back and crash, and for 2 days feel quite down and depressed because I've not had any goodness. So I'm just beginning to come out of that this morning.
Have you put a vegetable in you since again. You've got back? Have you been
I
getting
have.
Them in? Okay.
I had broccoli on crumpets for lunch yesterday, so there you go.
Nobody has broccoli on a crumpet as a foodstuff.
No, and I found out yesterday why they don't, because it was bloody horrible. It did not go anywhere. There you go.
I mean, I admire you trying to get the veg in the diet, but that's just not a thing.
No, it didn't work, Jane. Don't ever try it. I put a bit of brown sauce on it in the hope that that would help, but it didn't.
There's no hope. Okay, Matt, what have you been watching? And please tell me you've not been putting weird veg on toasted items.
Nothing eating weird like that. And I haven't really been watching much, to be honest, besides the stuff this week. I watched Turning Red, which you obviously reviewed last week, which I loved. But yeah, because of the kind of COVID attacking my household, there hasn't been as much time for just kind of fun viewing.
You've just been viewing COVID tests. That's been your
basically yes, just waiting
the line
to appear. Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes there's like a little twist ending where the line just suddenly appears right at the end when you weren't expecting it.
What about you, Jane? What have you been watching?
I've been watching the BAFTAs in person. That's what I did at the weekend. Obviously I usually do go, but the last few years haven't because of the pre-mentioned COVID situation. So this was the first like BAFTAs proper in person at the Albert Hall thing that all of the stars could come to. Although quite a few of them didn't make the journey. Mm. It was quite a weird one because of that doubling up with the Critics' Choice Awards. A lot of them stayed for that. It wasn't as starry as it has been, but still it was very, very nice to sort of sit in a room of industry people and hear the enthusiasm for particularly, you know, the people like the sound departments and costume and stuff, because they were there en masse, very, very thrilled to be there to celebrate this in person. So it was good. What did you reckon to Rebel Wilson? There's been a lot of talk about that she was the worst BAFTA host ever. I think that's a bit harsh.
But I don't know. I haven't watched it, but I've read weirdly sort of diverse reviews of Rebel Wilson, from people saying she was great to people saying she was absolutely awful. So I don't know. I mean, what did you think? You were there.
In the room, I thought she was very funny, but I did have a problem with the fact that she kept relying on sort of being very sexually aggressive towards, you know, like Benedict Cumberbatch or Tom Hiddleston or Daniel Craig. And it was just like, that felt weird, because if that was a guy doing that about women, it would not be okay. So yeah. That aspect, I think, felt quite flat. But the rest of it, I sort of enjoyed, you know, I thought she did a decent enough job and kept it going along. And it's also, I think it's always nice when the host actually works in the industry, you know, they're actually in film and making films. Joanna Lumley felt a bit TV to me to be doing the film BAFTAs. Mm. Sorry, Joanna, I know you have been in films, but just so associated with Ab Fab, she didn't feel like that much of a film person. And then obviously that her script had been written for her and felt a bit damp, whereas this was at least Rebel's own work. But yeah, you know, maybe I was just giddy. And also the magnum of champagne that was in the box that they left could have something to do with my enjoyment, because I got there and there was this beautiful magnum of champagne sort of sweating in an icebox. And I was like, well, who's that for? And I asked someone, I was like, am I in the right box? And she was like, no, you can open that. So I did have the pleasure of popping the cork of a magnum of champagne, which I don't think I've ever done and will never probably ever do again in my life, because who drinks a magnum of anything? I don't.
I saw someone tweeting as well, I think it was Edgar Wright. I agree with what he basically said along the lines of, can we move the awards sort of hosts away from just the being kind of roasts, you know, just do something a bit more sort of sincere. And I wouldn't mind seeing that, because I find a lot of the jokes just so awkward, because, you know, they're obviously made to kind of put people on the spot and kind of embarrass them. And then they're obviously stuck there in the audience with their peers and they've got to kind of smile awkwardly. So I just think, yeah, let's have something more sincere, more straightforward, more kind of, you know, heartfelt and celebratory of the industry. That's what I would like to see.
It's difficult though, because the BAFTAs used to have like Stephen Fry for many years, and
I loved him.
And they've had Jonathan Ross, and I actually didn't particularly like either of them, because I just found them too sycophantic. They're just like, I mean, they do what they do, but they were sort of, you know, bigging up everyone and really heaping the praise on and all of that, especially Stephen Fry. And I just kind of found it.
But that's part of his shtick, where he says, look at the lovely, glowing, ethereal beauty that is Meryl Streep. That's how he talks about everyone. That's what he'd say about you, Jamie. He'd say, look at this gorgeous, glowing, long-haired titan of a man sitting here with his broccoli on toast. It is the wonderful Jamie Graham.
I actually once played a frame of snooker against Stephen Fry, and he was exactly like that. And I beat him on the final black, and I potted the black, and he was like, what a wonderful shot. Oh, well done. That was one. Right. So, yeah, he is like that. But but I don't know. I don't think the BAFTAs ever quite get it right, is what I'm trying to say. I don't think they've ever nailed the host and the tone that they always seem to just miss. But maybe that's me. I'm in a grumpy mood today, aren't I?
Shall we get on and see if the next film, which is a little slice of sort of dreamland, might actually perk you up a little bit. It's time to get on the green with this.
And he's done it. Just goes to show, if you put your mind to it, you can achieve anything you want to.
I'm going to have a crack at the British Open.
Golf!
The British Open is the most respected tournament in the world.
I never even played bloody golf before, Dad.
Mind your language on the course.
F***ing hell.
It says professional. You sure?
Well, practice is the road to perfection.
Welcome on the tee, Maurice Flitcroft.
Don't adjust the television. This is actually happening.
So this is The Phantom of the Open. That's the true story of Maurice Flitcroft, an amateur golfer who entered the British Open in the 70s to the bemusement of fans, commentators and the golfing community. Before we talk about this film, let's hear from the film's director, actor, writer and helmer, Craig Roberts. I sat down with him last week to discuss The Lure of a Dreamer.
Four!
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle.
So obviously we got Just Jim and Eternal Beauty, and this is now The Phantom of the Open, and a sort of different tone from the previous films you've done. Tell me about how you found this story, because it's not something that a lot of people are aware of, this guy that entered the British Open, having never played a round of golf before, and there he is, you know, with all the pros on the green. How did it come to you? Was it at Scriptform, or had you heard of it before then?
Yeah, Simon had written the script, and it was already there was a really good draft of it. And Simon actually came to London Film Festival to see Eternal Beauty, my second film. And I think they just liked the tone of it, and they liked how it dealt with an outsider, I suppose, that, you know, it was constructed in a way that you weren't meant to laugh at them. You're supposed to laugh with. And I think that probably worked for their script. So I read the script and I loved it. I loved it. And it's interesting. It is a different tone to the first two films I made. And that's mainly, I think, because I didn't write the script. Right. I think it's, you know, it's when I look at it, when I had it, I was like, my God, I could never write anything this commercial or accessible. So I have to do this. Like all the stuff that I write is slightly abstract and really out there. So that I saw as a challenge. And then it was just about really finding my way into it. And I was worried about doing somebody else's script, because for me, it blows my mind that the people that write scripts can hand it over, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like if you create a world, it's amazing for somebody to be able to hand it over. I could never do that. So yeah, it was about staying true to, you know, Simon's material and the obviously Morris and his spirit, but also finding my way into it. And weirdly, there was a scene, and it's going to go back to Punch Drunk again, but there was a scene where in the script that Morris comes out of the shipyard and he opens his overalls like Superman. And as soon as I read that, I was like, Punch Drunk Love. I was like, okay, so maybe there's a way of putting that in there somewhere. So actually throughout the movie, there's just loads of little Easter eggs that he's Superman.
Oh, I'm going to have to rewatch it now.
Yeah, actually, somebody watched it, I think, at like a Cineworld screening the other day, and they'd figured it. I didn't think anyone would figure it out because it's so hidden, but the number plate is his name, and somebody saw that, which is good. So that made me happy.
Cool. I love it when there's Easter eggs. That's brilliant. So you talked about the fact that, you know, not laughing at Morris, but laughing with him. Was it important that you totally believed this guy was for real? Because obviously he tried to enter the open several times under all sorts of crazy names, Arnold Palmtree being one of the brilliant ones, Baron von something or another. So to some people he may be sort of looked at as a con man rather than a sort of dreamer. Was it important that you identified with that side of it and that's how we're presenting him here?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And that comes with Mark, really. Mark's such a great actor that he's able to ground absolutely everything. And he's incredibly relatable as an actor. So, you know, in his performances. So that was really there. I mean, the tone was great. But with Mark, when he came on and we talked about the script, he was all about grounding it and not playing to the comedy too much. And I felt that was right as well. A reference that I had in my head was The King of Comedy. And mainly because it's such a fantastic movie, obviously, but there's no better setup for me than somebody that thinks they're funny and everybody's telling him he's not funny. Like, that's so great. And that felt really right for Morris. And it's weird, I just mentioned this a minute ago, but the new Kanye West documentary has just come out, and I watched that and I loved it. It's fantastic. And whether you like Kanye or, you know, are behind what he says and stuff like that, there's something really inspiring about, certainly in the earlier episodes of that documentary, of him going into these record labels and being like, I am great, I can do it. And I think it's refreshing. I think we're always told to be humble and play it down, but sometimes you've really got to believe in yourself. And I think even though, you know, it didn't work out for Morris like it did for Mr. West, but I like that. I like that a lot about the story. You know, he's defying his birth lottery, you know, yeah, the cards that were dealt and going against it. And I think that's probably why people like underdog stories so much, because it's proper escapism. It's what can you do if you really put your mind to it? And I feel like, you know, now's a good time, hopefully, for people to have some form of escapism.
Yeah, absolutely. We need it more than ever. You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because it does sound like the life of an actor, really, that you're putting yourself forward for roles and you have to really be like, I absolutely can do this. Is that something that you sort of identify with, that element of Morris's psychology?
Yeah, to be honest, it's actually more so with filmmaking. With my first couple of films that I made, you really have to go into these rooms with people that have the money and be like, this is going to be amazing. And you're questioning whether it's going to be amazing itself. You really don't know, because obviously nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but nobody really knows what the secret ingredients are to a great movie. It's kind of, you know, more than the sum of its parts. It just comes together somehow when the stars align. That, yeah, certainly with like the filmmaking side of it, like going into rooms and having to present the Mr. West of yourself and say that you could do this, I certainly relate to 100%.
Yeah, you talked about the underdog, and this is sort of, it sort of reminded me a little bit of Forrest Gump in a way, this sort of idea of, you know, just going for your dreams and having no sort of reality infect that idea. What sort of, is that something that you like to watch as well as a film goer, that the underdog story and the dreamer. Are there other films like that that you sort of looked at when you were making this that represented it? I mean, you mentioned other films before, but were there other ones you looked at?
In terms of underdog, I mean, I always look to 8 Mile, and I know that's a really weird reference, but I love 8 Mile. It's like the rap Rocky. I suppose with 8 Mile, there's a way of shooting that movie where it does feel like a full-on biopic of Marshall Mathers, and it can be, I suppose it could be bright and more appealing to certain audiences, but it's really gritty and it's grounded, 8 Mile. It's really gritty. And it's beautifully shot. That wasn't a reference for this movie. I never mentioned 8 Mile to people, but I think when we were making this, I definitely didn't want to make a down the line, like kind of biopic, you know, yeah, where it's all super, super bright and super, super positive all the time. I don't think life is like that. And I think that's why we, hopefully it looks slightly different to the normal biopic. We try to shoot on film and try to, I suppose, just again, ground it in a strange way, because there are like moments of fantasy and elements of like escaping and stuff in the movie. But I think it's nice to have a bit of both of, you know, if you can ground it more in reality, then hopefully those kind of Billy Liar moments feel more true to the character.
So that's Craig's take on Morris Flitcroft and his sort of wild ideas about golf. Jamie, tell us a little bit more about the film. Set it up for us.
Well, it's exactly what you said, really. It's quite a basic plot in terms of it's a true story, but this guy, Morris Flitcroft, who lived in Barrow-in-Furness in Cumbria, and he was a shipyard operator, and he just one day decided, oh, I want to take up golf and I'm going to be really good at golf. And he started hacking away in the bunkers and was very, very average. And then
that's quite generous, Jamie.
and then he decided to enter the British Open, and by a kind of a mix up and various sort of just nightmarish scenarios of just bureaucracy going wrong, he managed to get into it. And suddenly there he was live on TV in 1976 doing his thing, just going around this course, taking God knows how many shots on every hole. And he recorded the worst score ever in British Open history, going up against all these incredible professionals. And it was just like if me or you suddenly appeared next to Seve Ballesteros, sort of swinging a club, missing the ball, hacking it into the rough. That's what he did. And so that is the story. And without giving too much away, it then goes beyond that, because any other film you'd think it would lead up to this sort of Open Championship in 1976. And that would be the climax of the film, him going round up against the professionals. But that actually happens sort of midway through the film. And then the remarkable story continues. And I'm not going to say any more because you should discover it for yourself. But this Morris Flitcroft guy had quite an incredible life. And sort of it is just very, very funny. Very funny to see him do it. But it's also got that balance that it's quite moving as well. You know, it's not just an all-out comedy. It's a comedy drama where it's also about his dreams, his ambitions, his home life. His wife is played by Sally Hawkins, and just that eternal sort of optimism of trying to do something you love and trying to do it well and trying to succeed. So there's a lot in this film, and I really loved it. I thought it was absolutely great.
Matt, what did you think?
I was similar to Jamie in that I really liked it. And it's one of those films, sort of like Jamie said, on paper, and especially if you kind of see the posters, if you hear the premise, you sort of get an idea of what this sort of British film might be like. This kind of quirky underdog story, when you see the kind of nature of the supporting cast, like Sally Hawkins and Risa Fans, Simon Farnaby, who kind of writes it, he makes an appearance as well. You kind of get a sense of the sort of comedy it might be. And while it is very funny in places, it was also, yeah, it was very, very touching as well, I thought. And it was, yeah, just different to what I thought it was going to be. I thought there was a nice kind of sort of style and sort of texture to it. There's this sort of almost kind of handmade kind of quality to it, and there's these kind of almost fantasy sequences it goes off into, which I liked, and again made it feel a bit different to this sort of, you know, this kind of British film and this kind of setting where it's very much working class. You know, like he comes from, you know, he's very much lives in this working class environment, and the whole family are kind of involved in that to one way or another. On the one hand, I did find the golf stuff hilarious. Like I was just absolutely in hysterics when he started playing his first proper round of golf. Then I really liked where it went after that. There's sort of some interesting stuff with the family and his relationship to his sons. He's got one son who's sort of trying to make something of himself in the business world almost. And he's got a couple of twins as well who kind of want to be professional disco dancers. And I thought it was really well handled the way they balanced that kind of, you know, wider family aspect. And yeah, I just really enjoyed it. I loved Mark Rylance in it as well. He's kind of just bemused, not really giving anything away, just sort of bumbling along. Like, I don't know, I just loved his performance.
This sort of has a lot in common with The Duke, doesn't it? In as much as it's a similar sort of Ealing comedy sort of vibe and that gentle kind of not sort of mean-spirited laughing with someone rather than at them. But also the sort of idea of British eccentrics and celebrating British eccentrics, these sort of people that just have an idea and just go for it, regardless of whether that's, you know, in the case of The Duke, illegal and kind of dangerous to do, or in this case, character assassinating, to actually put your name on the line as a professional golfer when you've actually never played a round. That aspect of it is kind of inspiring, isn't it? Like, just, you know, Morris in this just believes that if he practices enough, perfection can be found. And that's all that stands between him and a professional golfer. Like, why would he not be able to? Also, this delightful sort of cast iron belief that it will just be all right. Everything will be all right. And that seems to be how he's gone through his life. You know, he marries this woman that has a child already and at that time is frowned upon, and she gets called names and so does the kid for being a single parent and not having a dad, so to speak. And he'll happily take that on and be like, that'll be fine. That'll work out. You know, he has these friends and he's a crane driver, and he's just like, when redundancies loom their head, he's like, that'll be fine. That'll work out. And with this, he takes a shot, closes his eyes, and in his head, that ball is sailing down the green straight towards the hole, when in reality, it's in a bush somewhere. That sort of fabulist rather than sort of fantasist is really intoxicating to watch, isn't it? And as you say, Mark Rylance just doing, he's like the big friendly golfer. He's just like got this very gentle voice that Morris did talk. I mean, obviously, I don't know about you. I Googled Morris and his weird things that he did, like his breakfast TV appearances and stuff, where they try to make him putt golf balls in the studio. And he's absolutely hopeless. And he literally can't understand why they're sort of laughing at him. He's just like, what? You know, there's a slope on the floor. It is intoxicating. And also, I think it is really interesting to see Craig Roberts do something this commercial. His previous films have been, you know, and he says so himself, quite sort of niche and dark. So it's really interesting to see him take on a sort of Dexter Fletcher kind of role as a director of a real sort of heartwarming crowd pleaser. So, yeah, I think a lot of people would enjoy this.
The question of tone is an interesting one, because, like you said, Craig before has been quite a sort of serious, almost auteur kind of filmmaker with Eternal Beauty and Dear Jim, that he wrote those scripts and he takes cinema very seriously, which nothing wrong with that. And then with this one, he himself has said that his original cut was a lot darker because his sort of serious nature came out, and he made a film that was a little bit darker. And then they kind of massaged it and edited it and brought the humour up a little bit more, and did go for, like you said, this kind of Ealing comedy thing in the end, that where it's a small man up against the system and it's very endearing and sweet and moving. And I think they got the tone just right, but this is better than it would have been if they'd done the darker version.
Yeah.
And it is a little bit more commercial, but in a good way, but it's a complete crowd pleaser.
It's a four quadrant, isn't it? Like, kids would enjoy this. Yeah, you know, adults, old, young, whatever. The entire family can enjoy this film.
Film you could shove on at Christmas, isn't it? Because just everyone's going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, if it had been out in time, this would have been my Christmas film this year, but my family all come round, all ages, and we always watch a film on Boxing Day, and it's so hard to get that film that everyone would love. And if this had been out a couple of months earlier, I would have stuck this on. Phantom of the Opera, perfect choice for all the
Phantom
family.
Of the Opera? You're going to put a double bill? Phantom of the Opera Phantom of the Open. Yeah. Two very different
double
things.
Double bill. No, Phantom of the Open, and everyone would have loved it. Everyone would have been grinning and would have had the feels. And it's just a really, really well-made, smart, good film with lots of little idiosyncrasies as well that Matt sort of touched on earlier, the fantasy sequences and stuff. And the camera moves. It's very mobile camera. And he just brings everything to life. It's really vibrant. It's just great. It's a really good little film.
And as he says in that chat, he basically has loads of Superman Easter eggs in the film that if you watch it again, you'll probably see those in terms
there's
of
definitely
colour.
One obvious one I noticed. Yes, I noticed more than one.
Yes, yeah. But there's other things and like number plates and things that are nods. So I want to watch it again just to catch those little in jokes as well.
I would definitely watch it again. Yeah, it's a very easy watch.
So I think we're probably highly recommending this, aren't we?
Yes.
Yes.
Indeed.
Okay, so that is The Phantom of the Open, not opera, which is out in cinemas on Friday. And do let us know if it inspires you to take up golf. From a fantasist to sexual fantasies now. It's this.
You love me?
Of course.
You're not born.
No.
The fact that she's comfortable flaunting all these relationships around all of us, you're better than that.
She's different. That's what I like about her.
I just want to feel joy in my life.
You want to tell me why you didn't come home last night?
Not really.
This isn't a game, Melinda.
It's always been a game.
So this is deep water. I feel like we have to talk about deep water in sort of really sort of sexy tones. Matt, what's it about?
Hopefully my COVID voice will kind of add to this. So this is Adrian Lyne's return to the erotic thriller genre, and he hasn't made a film in 20 years since Unfaithful with Diane Lane. Notably, this one has obviously got a lot of attention because it stars Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas, who started dating while they were shooting it and sort of broke up not too long afterwards. But it kind of has that sort of, you know, life imitating art sort of allure to it as well. And plus, I mean, we just don't really get many erotic thrillers these days, do we? Like, kind of since Adrian kind of took a long hiatus, we haven't really had that many. This is adapted from an old novel by Patricia Highsmith. The bones of the story are bones.
Go on.
There's this married couple, Vic and Melinda, played by Affleck and Diarmas. The basic gist is that she's kind of having these extramarital affairs in such a way that, you know, you're kind of sort of led to think he's sort of enjoying it. He's kind of getting a sort of vicarious thrill out of it himself, into, you know, kind of seeing this happen and watching her kind of go off with these younger guys. And then from there, like, there's kind of, you know, there's a story of like a missing person, and then it kind of turns into something of a sort of murder mystery type thriller when people, particularly her lovers, end up turning up dead. And it's like, oh, what's going on there? So that is deep water.
Mm. So Unfaithful was, I found, for an erotic thriller, actually erotic. Does this get you going? Jamie, you're smiling. Oh. Are you smiling with pleasure? And I'm not talking about that kind, but was this a pleasurable experience?
It was pleasurable in that it was so bad, it was almost good. It's really disappointing in terms of I went into it, like Matt just touched upon, we don't have many erotic thrillers anymore. And I do want that genre to come back, you know, be it stuff like Adrian Lyne did Fatal Attraction 9.5 weeks back in the day. And I want those kind of 80s, 90s erotic thrillers, Basic Instinct. Like, you know, we don't get enough sex in the cinema anymore. And I was bang up for this. I was like, yep, yeah, here we go. This is going to be really good. It's just slightly risible.
Slightly.
Well, very risable. The kind of suspense elements of it don't work at all. And it's not, you know, the mystery elements, they kind of fall apart early on. There's no excitement in it, be it sexual excitement or just the excitement of a good thriller. It gets to a point, I've got to say, that there's a bike race. There's a
car
race.
I was laughing out loud.
I watched this film on my own, yeah, and I was just laughing aloud then. Sorry, carry on.
That's fine. Yeah, it's a bike chasing a car. So it's a bike and car chasing
a mountain bike.
A mountain bike.
Out of shape middle-aged man on a mountain bike chasing a car at full speed.
And it is absolutely ludicrous. And we're meant to be going along with this, sort of finding it exciting and scary and thrilling and suspenseful. And like you said, I was just in fits of laughter. And strangely, for an erotic thriller, there's hardly any sex in it. There's only a couple of sequences. And to be honest, I mean, without wanting to sound like a perv, you do want more sex in an erotic thriller. You know, partly what you're paying your money for. You want those hot and steamy sequences that we used to get back in the 80s and 90s, and it really does stint on those. But
when you compare it to sort of, you know, Alex Forrest getting into the sink in Fatal Attraction, and, you know, all of the tap switching on and off and the shaking of the crockery while she Dan get down to it,
famous bit in 9 1/2 weeks with the ice cubes and the nipples. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you want to be talking about, and there's none of that in here.
It's one of those astonishing things, isn't it? That weird thing that it's so strange when people are actually living the romance in real life that weirdly it often doesn't translate on screen. Mm. And often people who either hate each other in real life or are not remotely interested in each other are a lot hotter together. So this was like the least hottest coupling I've seen for a long time. And I didn't understand what the hell I was supposed to be getting out of it. Mm. Didn't understand his motivation, Affleck's husband's motivation at all. There was this massive amount of snails in it discussion of snails and snails like crawling up windows and him going, oh, snails have to get to the top of a big pole. And it's like, okay, so are you a snail, Ben? And you want, like, you need to get to the top of a pole to really get your rocks off with Melinda. Also the fact that they're called Vic and Melinda, which sounds like a couple from Essex, not, you know, people who are living in the deep south in this massive mansion. He's weirdly rich, and the reasoning for him being rich, what was it, Matt? He developed a flying drone or something and he never worked again.
Yeah, there's sort of an offhand reference that he developed a chip that goes into drones or something to give him some weird sort of murky morality. But yeah, this was one of those films.
He's just a drone inventor.
They've been used in drone warfare, haven't they? So he's sort of partly responsible or indirectly responsible for killing lots of people. So, you know, that gives his morality a dark edge.
And then you've got a little kid in it. They've got a daughter. The daughter talks to the dad about mum bonking other people in a sort of, you know, like, why is mum different with other people? And he's like, oh, that's just the way she is and I like it. Like, why are we having this conversation? Very strange. He serves her wine occasionally. She's 5. It's all very strange. It doesn't make any sense. Somebody discovers something that they really need to tell the police immediately and instead spends that time texting someone else to say, hey, guess what I discovered, to their detriment. None of it makes sense. These people are all really weird, really stupid, and frankly deserve everything they get when you're watching it. However, I must say, it's one of those films that's so dreadful, I really enjoyed it. Did you?
I'd be tempted to watch it again and see if I had that feeling.
Oh,
it does
really? Wonder why, Matt?
But it feels like it has that potential to be a kind of cult sort of drinking game type film, or, you know, the sort of film that you watch with a group and just like howl along to. But this was one for me where I've seen a few reviews doing the rounds this week that are kind of, you know, around the 2-star zone. But this for me was just a 1-star. It just was that bad for me. And particularly, I thought it was one of Ben Affleck's worst performances. He just looks so kind of bored throughout and so kind of just uninvolved. And obviously, I mean, sometimes that can be a character choice, whatever, you know. You don't get the sense that he's kind of enjoying, you know, I don't know, you don't get the sense that he's being turned on by these dalliances that she's having. You just don't get anything from him. She's
doing all the heavy lifting.
Yeah, exactly. She always has some spark on screen. You know, so you can see why these people are kind of attracted to her, obviously. But I just found all the guys were so dweeby. There's some weirdly good supporting actors in it as well, such as like Tracy Letts. I don't know what he's doing here.
Yeah.
And Finn Wittrock as well, who's someone I always kind of, you know, like anticipated big things for him, but he just never seems to have quite had that proper breakout role you'd think he might have got by now. Just as one of her kind of exes turned, you know, like sort of flames. And what's he doing as well? Like, and I really felt a lot of the time, I felt like they could have edited a very different film out of this. It felt so choppy and all over the place. And certain things just didn't add up to me. And it starts out with this bit of a murder mystery. When that moves forward, it's suddenly like, oh, right, we've given up on this sort of mystery idea. And it's just this, you know. Just didn't work on any level really for me, so that's why.
And the basic premise
fell into
as well,
that one, like, star camp
that, you know, he lets her have affairs, because we don't know, because it's never said, but presumably because he enjoys the thrill of that, but doesn't get anything out of it, really. It would have been better had it just been a couple where he gets off on seeing her get off. Or he gets furious because she's getting off with other people.
To me, it seemed all over the place that one minute he seems to be getting off on her having affairs. Then he seems to absolutely hate it and get enraged by it. And then she seems to hate the fact that he's not getting enraged enough. And then she hates the fact that he gets too enraged and that he's poking his nose into her business. And it seemed like every 10 minutes, the motivation was completely different. And not in a sort of good shifting focus, kind of murky, keep you guessing kind of way, just in a kind of way that it's all over the shop, like the film is an absolute mess. The reason I'll never go back and watch this film again is just because it is so boring. I can take a film being like, you know, so bad it's good, and it kind of hit that territory with a bike car chase that was so bad it was good. But most of it, I just found tedious. That I was just sat there really, really bored.
Yeah.
Like watching paint dry. And if there's one thing in an erotic thriller you shouldn't be, it's bored.
Just some really laughable death scenes in it as well. So others just sort of had me howling.
Yeah. Oh. And then scenes where she's talking to him in a sort of sexy fashion, and she's beautiful and it's working. And I feel like she really does want to get rude and dirty with Ben Affleck. And he's looking at her in apparently turned on way, but just looks cross-eyed and like he's got sort of something's disagreed with him at lunch. I don't understand. These two people actually did have sex. How can't they emote that on screen? It's very weird. Are we telling people then that they should be watching this? I mean, the thing is, it's not coming out in cinemas anymore. It was destined for cinemas. It's now coming onto a streaming service. It's probably the best place for it, isn't it? To watch this with a curry and have a good old giggle.
Yeah. You know, if you're having a drink at home or, yeah, like watching it with friends or something like that, that's your best bet for this, I think.
Drink every time Ben Affleck looks constipated. You'll be absolutely battered in no time. Okay, so that is Deep Water, which also we don't know why it's called that. There's some water in it. None of it's particularly deep. Who knows? That is out on Amazon Prime on Friday. Okay, so now it's time for alternative line reading. And I'm going to this one, as you always say, Matt, it's play the player, not the game.
Okay.
This is a quote from a famous film that has a link to something else we've talked about. I'm going to do it in the style of the BFG in honour of Mark Rylance in The Phantom of the Opera. Why? Because I won't allow you to treat me like some slut frizzle bozzle, and you can just bang a few times and throw in the garbage. I'm going to be the mother of your child, and I want a little respect.
Very good BFG there. I think
it was a little bit more like, film. I think Jamie would say that was a bit more Somerset than BFG, but I feel like the BFG is a bit of Somerset. So
yeah, a bit of West Country burr to that. I've no idea what that
I think I know.
Go on.
Is it Fatal Attraction?
It is Fatal Attraction, and it sounds like this.
Because I won't allow you to treat me like some slut you can just bang a couple of times and throw in the garbage. I'm going to be the mother of your child. I want a little respect.
Right, so after all that eroticism, we probably just want a nice dating movie, don't we?
Do you live around here? Because I live on aisle 6.
That was terrible.
It was kind of terrible.
What's his Instagram? I want to stalk a little bit.
He doesn't have one.
Say what?
Yeah.
Oh, no. See, that's shady.
Let's play a game. Tell me something you don't want me to know.
I hate this.
Okay.
Put all our hopes of finding happiness through someone else.
Yeah.
Girl, you are all digmatized and I haven't even seen this dude.
What's going on?
I'm gonna tell you, but you're gonna freak out.
No, this isn't happening.
Yeah, it's happening. No games. Not what you wanted?
So this is Fresh, and it's about a couple meeting in a supermarket, isn't it, Jamie?
It is indeed. Daisy Edgar-Jones, who we all know from Normal People, she plays Noah. We meet her when she's embroiled in the dating game that she goes on a couple of dates and basically they're awful. She meets this guy who he starts going on about the fact that women today aren't feminine enough and that they wear these big comfortable clothes and they don't make an effort. And then he starts monologuing about hot sauce and he's just really weird and really boring and really offensive. And all the dates seem to be like this. So it's just really bad. And just when she's giving up hope, by pure chance, she bumps into Steve, played by Sebastian Stan, the Winter Soldier. She bumps into Steve in the sort of fresh produce aisle of the local supermarket. And he's handsome and he's charming and he's funny and he seems just really normal, which is what she needs, a nice normal guy. So she starts dating him, has a couple of wonderful dates, is already beginning to sort of fall for him a little bit and him for her, apparently. And he invites her away for a weekend retreat to have a lovely romantic weekend. And then we're going to stop there and not say any more because things take a turn.
Yes. There's so much we could discuss about this film, isn't there? But the problem with it is if we do discuss any of those elements, all of which are funny, gross, challenging, and have something actually important to say about women and dating and predatory men, it makes this whole thing redundant if you go and see it. I saw this at Sundance, knowing nothing about it, and can honestly say I was floored by it. I thought it was so excellent and really was like the follow-up to it, to something like A Promising Young Woman. It has that much of power and punch. Did you like it, Jamie?
Didn't like it as much as you, Jane, in that I did like it. Don't get me wrong. I think it's good. I recommend it. I would definitely say to all listeners, go and see it. It's well worth it. But it didn't absolutely bowl me over. I didn't love it like you do. I went in knowing a little bit more. I think it's safe to say, you know, people know it's a kind of social thriller or a horror tinge movie. I think we can say that. So you kind of know it's going to go into dark places, but I don't want to say more than that. What I did really like about it, I thought Sebastian Stan was excellent, really charming and charismatic and creepy and just nasty all at once. I love the fact that it does go to some really nasty, gnarly places. There's definitely a lot of wincing involved. What I maybe didn't love about it is I suspected where it was going to go, and it did, but it is done very well, and it's done with a lot of sort of pace, and it's very fresh. It's directed by Mimi Cave. Boom, boom. Yeah, it's directed by Mimi Cave, who's done music videos before, and I think she brings a lot of kind of zip to it and style without being overly stylized. So it's not kind of off-putting the MTV or anything. You know, the characters are recognizably real. You kind of feel it. And like you said, Jane, it does have things going on under the surface that, on the one hand, it's a very entertaining genre movie where you can just take that from it and just enjoy it for what it is. But if you want it, there is stuff going on about kind of toxic men and dating and what men expect of women and how they kind of control them and use and abuse them and use their bodies and stuff like that. So there is stuff there as well. So it's good. You know, I do definitely recommend it. I just don't absolutely adore it like you do.
I mean, I think in the current climate, when we're talking about women's agency over their own bodies with changing abortion laws, it has a lot to say about that, but in an entertaining fashion and without hitting you over the head. What did you think, Matt?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. You're definitely advised to go in knowing as little as possible. It's one of those films that, for me, I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't say it's sort of one for the ages and one that I'll be talking about in years to come, you know, that sort of thing. But for the time that it was on, it really kind of grabbed me. It's really kind of gripping and tense. There's a lot to think about. There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to kind of, you know, squirm at. You know, you've got to hope that your friends have watched it as well, because it is one of those films you just want to kind of talk about once you've seen it. So it is very enjoyable, I found. But yeah, perhaps not, you know, not one that's going to leave a lasting mark on the history of cinema, but a really kind of enjoyable blast to throw on. And I think sort of, you know, a lot of people will kind of watch it, will see it, kind of those two sort of attractive stars. If you see them on the sort of carousel on Disney Plus when you log in, I think you'd be tempted to watch that. And obviously, I think the people who can go in with the least expectation will kind of have the most fun, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Sebastian Stan's on a roll at the moment, isn't he? What with taking that sort of, as you mentioned, Winter Soldier kind of image and just turning it on its head with Pam and Tommy, and now with this. I mean, without giving anything away, he does some great disco dancing that's very amusing to watch. I just think he's turning into a really quite interesting actor, which is not what I would have said when we went back to sort of watching him in the Marvel films. I think he's choosing some really interesting projects. And Daisy, it's interesting to see her play this very different role from Marianne. I mean, she's completely polar opposite and doing a really good American accent. Mm. So, yeah, I would highly recommend it.
I do love these films where you get a couple of kind of stars or a couple of very attractive people, you know, up and coming stars, and you turn it on its head completely. And like you said, I do think people who don't know anything about this would kind of log in and they see the faces, they see the names, and they go, oh, yeah, I fancy that on a Friday night. And they sit down with their tea and they put it on to watch and would get quite a nasty shock. And I do like that. I like it when films kind of use people's baggage in a way, or their personas, and kind of turns it on its head and surprises you. So it does that very cleverly.
I wouldn't watch it eating your tea, is what I'd say. There we go. It's on Disney Plus, and it's quite an edgy little number for Disney Plus. And it's available this Friday. It's also a great calling card for Cave as well. Like, what will she do with a little bit more money and a bigger cast and even more, you know, control? What might she produce next? I can't wait to see. Right. Shall we move on to another first-time filmmaker, somebody else making their debut with a film? It's time to go to college with this.
So, you live here too?
Yeah.
The whole school's cursed.
Okay, you're gonna have to try a lot harder than that to scare me.
Seriously, it's real.
I understand. I went through it. Can I just...
This school is unwilling to see itself for what it truly is.
All right, so this is Master, not The Master, one of Jamie's favourites, but Master. What is it about, Matt?
So Master, this is the debut from writer-director Mariama Diallo. And broadly speaking, yeah, it's a horror film, let's call it that. And it's about a sort of liberal arts college that's sort of has a curse. And we sort of see it very much from the perspective of two black women, one of those being Regina Hall's Gail, who's the new sort of master of one of the sort of houses at the college, and the other being a new student, Jasmine, played by Zoe Renee. We sort of follow them and their experiences of this college as one, they sort of learn and hear more about this sort of mysterious sort of haunted element, you know, that there was a mysterious death many years before, and, you know, how that plays out, all the while kind of watching them face various kind of elements of sort of institutional racism and sort of facing various stereotypes and the way they're kind of treated by other people in the college. Their story strands start somewhat kind of separately, and then they sort of merge a bit as it goes on. That's how I would set it up for people.
This also premiered at Sundance this year, and it was compared to Get Out and Us, a sort of Jordan Peele's style of filmmaking. Jamie, as impressive as Jordan Peele?
No, not quite. I mean, the inevitable thing is it's going to be compared to Get Out, because it shares a lot in common with that, with all this kind of, there's a lot of microaggressions from the white characters towards the black characters. There's a lot of that thing of sort of liberal white people saying stuff that, you know, on the surface is okay, but it's loaded with subtext and reading between the lines, you know, it's really racist. About power structures, about patriarchy, about kind of how black people have been locked out of this privileged white school, you know, school in the past. And now, are they really making these changes because they want change, or are they making these changes to look good and to sort of look as if they're making changes when really they want things to stay exactly the same? So you could see why it would get the comparisons, but I don't think it's quite as sharp or as smart as Get Out. Having said that, it's a good genre movie. It's got things to say. It's very slick. It's entertaining. It's well acted. Regina Hall, I think, is particularly great. That she's had a really varied career, but we probably most think of her as a kind of comedic actress. We think of the scary movies, stuff like that. And this is quite a serious role, you know, where there's a lot put upon her. And I think she carries the movie really, really great. And I think she, yeah, is going to get a lot of kind of different work off the back of this. So, yeah, so I'd recommend it. I think it's a good genre movie, and fans of genre movies would definitely want to check it out. I just don't think it's anywhere near in the class of Get Out.
Oh, I really liked this. I thought it had so many things to say about everything, from the experience of the horror of having to live with a roommate in a, you know, that you've paired up with. I mean, I did this. I went to American college for a year, and I was put in a room with a random woman that I would never choose to spend any time with. And it was hideous. So that, just that whole horror of when you leave your high school and you're one thing, this girl is valedictorian of her high school and lives this very nice sort of middle-class life in Tacoma, Washington. And she moves across state to this New England fusty college, which isn't welcoming at all, to a horrible roommate and to the microaggressions and to the unconscious bias. And to sort of readjusting her idea of who she is in the world when she thought she knew what that was in high school, and then having to redo that. And then you've got the race aspects. You've also got the sort of difficult history of, you know, white settlers on the Eastern Seaboard and all of that. You've got witches and the treatment of women during the witch sort of hunts and the Salem witch trials. You've got American literature and the classic literature of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, and red plays a huge role in this film. It's a massive motif. I love the fact that this girl is trying to deconstruct the Scarlet Letter and trying to see things in it. And you can do exactly the same thing with this film. I think this film could be shown in one of those classes and the students could pick apart all of the very different things it's saying. You know, it's about decay. And then there's also, you know, appropriation of Black culture. Just all sorts of things going on here that you have an absolute feast. There's nothing vapid about this film. Really skillfully directed, a script that isn't completely spoon feeding you. And there are questions even at the end, like, was she that? Who did that? What happened there? There's gaslighting here, all sorts of things going on. It's just really, I found it a treat.
Yeah, I fell somewhere between the two of you, actually, where, yeah, I didn't love it quite as much as Jane, but I did just think
I'm having
really
a good
enjoyable.
Week here. Even the one I hated, I loved.
I did find it really enjoyable. I thought it was an absolutely kind of, you know, great debut, great calling card. And yeah, like while it never kind of obviously reached the heights of something like Get Out for me, I did just think it was like, it was sort of tense where it needed to be. It was kind of, you know, like you say, lots of interesting things throughout, two kind of great performances leading it, some sort of scary moments in there. It's kind of, you know, very, very intriguing. And yeah, definitely would recommend it.
The thing is, just to say, I would recommend it as well. I like it. And I think it is unfair to compare it to Get Out, but I'm saying that inevitably people are going to do that. And I've done that myself today. And it's kind of unfair. You know, why should it just be compared to Get Out? And that's a very, very high bar to go up against. But I would recommend it, just to say, on all your points, Jane, which were superbly made in terms of just how much there is in this film. You know, there's so much in it. But I kind of almost felt there was too much in it. It's like there's so many different themes and different things you can take from it and zero in on. But it kind of, to me, it was this big swirling kind of melting pot. I would have maybe preferred it to be a little bit more sort of focused on certain aspects. I found there was almost too much in it.
Well, I disagree. I thought it was ace. I'd watch it again and write essays on it. It's just the sort of meaty thing I enjoy. And also just real pleasure to see this is like a female director, female leads. And this is ultimately as well a very sort of female story as well. Like not only about all the things that I mentioned before, but it's about women competing in this world that's very much a man's world and a sort of fusty white man's world. Really, really interesting.
Also does sort of nightmares and sort of dreams very well as well. There's a lot of kind of, you know, these kind of characters get haunted by these sort of waking dreams almost. And I just thought that was just really well handled the way they did those.
I was just going to say, and this isn't really a criticism, it's just a note. It's quite of interest. Why is it in these films, whenever you have kids learning stuff at college or at school or at university, whatever, the book they're studying, it always kind of reflects on what they're going through. This is actually brought up in Easy A, Emma Stone's character, actually says this, you know, it always has something to do with the drama that's unfolding on the screen. And it's true. And while I loved all the Scarlet Letter stuff, it was kind of quite amusing. But again, it does that trope that it kind of all falls into a drama that we're watching the book that they're studying.
But you'd complain if they were reading, I don't know, Brightness Falls by Jay McInerney, and they were reading that and it had nothing to do with it. You'd be like, why did they spend so much time talking about that and the excess of the 80s and sort of East Coast elitism? You'd be like, you're never happy, Jamie.
No, I am happy.
Surely that's part of it, that it folds in and that it all talks to each other.
It is.
What do you want?
It is part of it. It is part of it, but it's just that whole thing with movies that they're also, sometimes things can be a little bit too patterned and a little bit too much, you know, a movie with a capital M, and you can almost feel the writer, the typewriter, sort of making sure that A links to B, links to C, links to D, and this comes back round. And I like films to just be a little bit more sort of loose in a way, rather than just so cleverly crafted down to every single line. I'm just saying that in general. I'm not aiming that at this film, you know, in particular. It is what it is, and it's very, very good, very enjoyable. I liked it.
It's 98 minutes long as well. It's snippy. It gets to the point.
Movies. Yeah.
Yeah. So for my money, Jamie, you can give me this over your licorice pizza. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, Jane, don't say that. Give me licorice pizza with its looseness, and it's just following life with every bend and turn, wherever it flows. That's what I want.
Give me a smartly scripted 98-minuter that really gets to the point anytime. All right, so this is The Master, and it's available on Amazon Prime on Friday. You can eat your dinner with that one. That's okay. Shall we move on then? Do we need a place to work after all of this, you know, working from home? These guys have you covered. Or do they? It's this.
The future of work looks different.
We're selling an experience.
We need a name.
We live.
We dream.
We work.
Who wins in a fight? The smart guy or the crazy guy? Are you crazy enough?
I may be.
So this is We Crashed, which is hitting Apple TV this week. Matt, what's it about?
Yeah, well, this is another thing. A lot of stuff we talked about today is premiered at festivals, and this is just premiered at South by Southwest, the one that's just happened this month. And it's a story which I kind of knew the very, very, very top line about this business, WeWork. The idea is you rent office space basically from them. It's very kind of, you know, chic and sort of fancy, but that's the gist. You rent this office space. So I knew really nothing about this. You kind of, the title tells you there's an element of kind of, you know, something's going to crash here. I've only seen the first episode of this, so, you know, that's where I'm going to kind of, what I'll introduce. But we're basically following Adam Newman, who is played by Jared Leto, and his wife, Rebecca. And it follows them. The first episode begins sort of just as there's some kind of crisis going down at the company. There's a sort of disastrous IPO happening. There's a big New York Times article that's just come out that's kind of seems to be slamming Adam. And there's this, you know, board meeting being called where they're basically going to tell him they don't want him on the board anymore. And as that's playing out, we then kind of flash back and we sort of see the start of Adam and Rebecca's relationship. And also we see Adam's kind of roots as this sort of entrepreneur who basically is trying anything. He's just trying all these different avenues to try and kind of, you know, make it big as an entrepreneur, basically. So we see him kind of developing these baby onesies with knee pads to sort of protect babies' knees. He tries to do this woman's shoe with a collapsible heel. He tries to do this kind of living space thing, this sort of living concept, which basically people just say it sounds like halls of residence, basically. And then that's the thing that ends up muting into this kind of shared workspace business. So from the first episode, we just really see how that's taking off. So it's very much sort of in the vein of, I mean, it's not quite The Social Network, but in that kind of vein, you know, about this kind of tech company, we're following the kind of, you know, genius slash, you know, like just charlatan behind it all. And yeah, that's what the show's about, basically.
We should talk about Jared Leto's accent and prosthetics. This is very much another kind of turn as he did in House of Gucci, isn't it? Big accent, big prosthetics, you know, a big character. Did that work for you, Matt?
From this first episode, I thought it was sort of decent, if again, if just not absolutely blown away, decent in that kind of 3-star level, where a lot of the elements did feel quite familiar. Like it feels that we've seen this kind of story quite a lot. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't kind of enjoy Jared once again. And I've got to say, full disclosure, like I enjoyed him a lot in House of Gucci. So I kind of enjoyed him again in this kind of larger than life. Adam Newman is Israeli. So Jared is doing this, you know, very big accent. I actually loved Anne Hathaway as well.
I thought she was great in this.
Yeah. She's got this kind of like, this kind of like, I can't really describe it almost, but like the tone of her voice.
It's sort of like if you've seen the Elizabeth Holmes story that Amanda Seyfried has done recently, where she has the lowered baritone voice of a woman who talks in a sort of West Coast sort of bored fashion lower. But it's also this inventing Anna aspect to it as well, isn't it? Sort of very wealthy people who are all talking in a bored, weird accent. So those two things come together for me and sort of quite enjoyed them on level. But if you actually watch footage of both of these people speaking, it feels like Jared's really upped it, panto styly, from what Adam actually speaks like, but Hathaway has nailed it. And Rebecca was like one of Gwyneth Paltrow's gurus, who used to talk on her Goop podcast and things about sort of wellness and yoga and everything, in that sort of very deep voice where she's like, I just don't, you know, you just got to take care of yourself. So she's totally nailing it. And yeah, I really enjoy seeing Hathaway do this sort of thing, because try as she might, she's just got that nice persona. And it's really nice to see her play someone who isn't that nice, actually.
And yes, left me intrigued to watch more. And it's kind of interesting that it's on at the same time as The Apprentice has returned to our TV screens for the first time in years, because there's just, especially this kind of first episode really made me think that a lot, where he's just doing whatever he can to sort of flog these products. I did buy into that sort of the sheer will of his charisma, how he kind of just can talk people into things, even when he's really like trying to sell this company, trying to get a valuation on it. And there's nothing to it really, but it's just the sort of sheer force of the way he can kind of just convince people that it's going to be something, and he can kind of sell this idea, that I did enjoy that.
But it's also not just him, is it? It's very much about the fact that these two are hustlers. They're just total hustlers. And separately, they weren't quite succeeding in what they were trying to do. She wanted to be this sort of yoga guru and sort of wellness expert, and he wanted to be a trillionaire, not a billionaire, a trillionaire. And that didn't gel until these two sort of nefarious folk got together and pooled their sort of hustle to create this sort of powerhouse of just sheer will and determination and ability to convince people that they needed what these two were selling. And it did work for them for a while until it didn't. It's one of those ones to watch, I think, with the inventing Annas and the dropout and other things like that, the Tinder swindler even, you know, these people with just cast iron self-belief. It is quite interesting to see people in those roles. So that is We Crashed, which is hitting Apple TV on Friday. Okay,
chuck in a Jared Leto story?
Chuck in a Jared Leto story, why don't you?
I interviewed him a couple of years ago for The Little Things, and literally on Zoom, and he popped up on Zoom, and I'd no more than said my opening gambit, just sort of, hello, how are you, where are you, etc. And he said, man, he was like, that is a great accent. He said, where are you from? And I said, oh, I grew up in the West Country in England. And he said, I'm going to steal that accent. You're going to see that in a future film. So everyone out there, just watch out, that I think in a couple of years' time, you're going to have Jared Leto playing a West Country farmer boy from Somerset or something. So
will it be better than my BFG impression, though, Jared? That's what I
say. It won't be as good as that, but he obviously does love an accent.
Jared needs to guest and do the bad line reading.
Oh, I'd love him to do that. Can we get him to? Let's ask.
Come on, Jared, if you're listening.
Yeah, come on. Okay, so that's our releases for this week. What is your release of the week, Jamie? What are you telling people to go and see above all else?
For me, by a distance, it is Phantom of the Open. I like both the kind of horror movies on display this week as well, Master and Fresh. I'd recommend both of those. But by a distance, Phantom of the Open is my film of the week.
Yeah, Phantom of the Open is my recommend, but with strong recommends for Master and Fresh as well. Even give We Crashed a go. And as we said, with huge caveats, you could sort of get something out of deep water under the right conditions. But that's
you might get like a yearning to keep snails out of it. That might be what it is.
But that is the dud of the week for me.
Yes, indeed. Mine would have to be The Master, not The Master. Sorry. Master. Yes. Must get this right because it's not the Paul Thomas Anderson film, which I loathe. It's which Master. I know you do. But this one doesn't involve somebody singing Slow Boat to China interminably. It so it's a it winner for me. But having said that, I did really enjoy Fresh as well and Phantom of the Open. So and Phantom of the Open is on the big screen. So you could watch the others at home and then take yourself out for a proper outing to the cinema with the other one. Okay, so time to go then. But before we do, time for reader's question, which I know Jamie's going to like because he's a super fan.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Tom Cruise movie? We've got Top Gun Maverick coming up. So I guess this is why this reader was inspired to ask this. Jamie, what is your favourite Tom Cruise movie?
Well, I'm such a super fan that I have to give two answers to this, Jane, and you should be thankful I'm not giving about 12 answers, but I'm giving two answers. I'm giving the best film he's ever been in and the best performance he's ever given is Magnolia, Paul Thomas Anderson, which he should have won Best Supporting Actor for. It was an absolute joke he didn't. An ensemble movie, but he is a standout of a standout ensemble cast. Then my second answer is my favourite Tom Cruise movie, which has to be the original Top Gun, because I was 14 when it came out. I watched it again and again and again. I owned it on video and I used to watch it every week. I must have seen it more than 50 times. I still go back to it every year or two and watch it. Still love it. Cannot wait for Top Gun Maverick. So that is my favourite, Top Gun.
Yeah, this is also a difficult one for me because there's just so many you could choose. And it's weird because he actually hasn't done as many films as you might kind of expect, given how long his career has been. But again, if I'm allowed to choose two, like Jamie, I'm going to go for Eyes Wide Shut just because I love Kubrick. I think that film has often been underrated and it's just such a different performance for him. And I like the way the film kind of, you know, plays on his persona and particularly, you know, his relationship with Nicole Kidman as well and kind of the way it deals with that and sort of uses that. Then I'm going to go for a really recent one and say Mission Impossible Fallout because I just absolutely love it. And I think it's one of those films that you basically couldn't make a better Mission Impossible film than this. It's sort of perfection in terms of what it sets out to achieve. Like there's about kind of a good six or so set pieces in the film that each would be the absolute standout of any other film. But they just keep coming in this film and it just gets everything right in terms of, you know, obviously you don't go to these sort of Mission Impossible films for the kind of plot in that sense, but it really works in the way it needs to, the way it balances the old characters. That's why I'm obviously ridiculously excited for Mission Impossible 7 and 8, but I just think, how are they going to top this? Because they've made like the perfect film in this mold.
Well, I'm sure Tom would say that they have and he knows what he's done and we'll wait and see.
Can I just say, I know someone, no names, but I know someone who's seen 20 minutes of the new Mission Impossible 7. And they said, obviously, they're going to show some of the big stuff in that 20 minutes, but they said it is absolutely staggering. And but it does top the last one, the bit they've seen. So we'll see.
Wow. Okay. Well, if you two are going to have two, I'm going to have two.
Yeah, come on, Jane.
So for old school Tom, I've got to have Risky Business. Dancing around in his socks and his shirt. If we're talking about erotic and sexual, as we are trying to in Deep Water, have a little go on Tom and Rebecca De Mornay. They are hot AF in that.
On the stairway.
When she comes in the garden door and he's on the lounge, in the lounge, and he's thinking, oh, I didn't want that to happen. And then she comes, the leaves are blowing, the music's playing. Let's talk about the train. I mean, hello.
Oh, the train. Oh, my God.
I had to question like what was going on in my body when I saw that as a teenager possibly, but like I feel funny. I don't understand. And then I have a very soft spot for Interview with a Vampire. I do enjoy Tom being a peevish sort of flouncing vampire with his lace cuffs going around biting people and, you know, trying to get off with Brad Pitt and not succeeding. I love that. Did it for me. So those are my two. I do love Top Gun. I just don't want to choose that because, you know, you've already done it.
There's so many. I mean, the man's career is incredible. Like, I'm going to have a third choice. I'm going Colour of Money because I think it's a massively underrated Scorsese film. And him as Vincent, this sort of puffed up little cocky pool player. He's just magnificent in that. And again, talking of charisma, the scene where he's dancing around the pool table to Werewolves in London, twirling his cue. I mean, just a natural born movie star.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not talk about Far and Away and the accents in that.
No, we'll leave that.
Mm. Okay. So, yeah, looking forward to Top Gun Maverick. Let's hope it actually comes out, seeing as it's moved a million times. But for now, that's it from us. Shall we say goodbye? And we'll be back next week with more. Say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
And it's bye from me.